Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is essayist, journalist, contributing editor, and reporter Heather Radke. And we're talking about her book, Butts, A Backstory. Heather, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me.
What pushed you over the edge to write a book about butts?
Well, when I was growing up in the 90s, I had a big butt. I'm a white woman. I grew up in the suburbs of Lansing, Michigan. And at that time in that place, having a big butt was kind of not fashionable and not beautiful. Kate Moss was super in, and I did not have Kate Moss's body. And then that kind of like changed significantly over the next 30 years, kind of like what body was fashionable. And then when I was a little bit older, in my mid-30s, I was in a writing program at Columbia University, and I kind of just got interested in that question of like how can it be that a body type or a body part can kind of come into fashion? It's so different than other kinds of things like shoulder pads or stretch pants or something. Like, you have so little control over what your body looks like. So I got really interested in that question, and then it kind of set me on this path to write this whole book.
It's amazing because you really go down the rabbit hole here, and in a good way. Yes. And you really branch out into a lot of different areas. We'll talk about that later. But this book is also sort of a memoir as you go along about your own sense of body image. And the pressure you felt, and also in relationship to your mother. Mother was the first butt you ever saw.
Yeah, that's the very opening line of the book. I mean, yeah, I think for women, and I'm sure for most people, really, that the relationship that their parents have with their body is kind of something that's passed down along with anything else. And it's, you know, something that I thought was interesting and important as I was writing the book was, I don't have any particularly horrible experience with feeling shame about my body or any kind of extreme experience. And instead, I sort of have what I call mundane shame. I think it's something most people have, some part of their body or something about them that they just kind of persistently don't like. And I was really also interested in that because I think those are the kinds of things that we can kind of forget to be curious about. Like, oh, I've never liked my butt. Oh, I've never liked my calves, or I always have this weird skin thing or whatever. But I think by becoming curious about those things and exploring mundane shame instead of just kind of the big shameful things that kind of can feel really grand and extreme, there's like actually a lot you can learn about the world and about yourself.
And for me, the book took some really interesting turns because a lot of the discussion becomes discussion about race and perceived images of culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Were you prepared for that, or you already knew all about that before you did all the research? I just want to mention, you did a ton of research in this book, and I was so impressed. But did you know the story was going to go there?
Yeah, you know, I think from the beginning, I knew any history of the butt was going to be a history of race and of blackness and whiteness in particular. I had known the story of Sarah Bartman since college when I took a class on racial anthropology, but I didn't know as like the sort of persistence and the deep legacy that her story had. And so I knew that that was always going to be part of the book, but then really getting into it and especially learning all that history of the 19th century, like pseudo racial science and the eugenicists, and then the way that the legacy of racialized bodies kind of comes down through the centuries. That was stuff I didn't know, although, you know, I shouldn't have been surprised by.
I had never read the story of Sarah Bartman. My emotions of reading your account of it was like reading about the Elephant Man, in the sense that the way an unfortunate individual was treated by society. And we should talk about her because Sarah's story echoes throughout many of the chapters of the book, and it somehow always gets back to that. So can we talk about Sarah Bartman for a while? She was called the Venus Hottentot, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And what time period are we talking about?
So we don't know exactly when she was born, but she was born in the late 1700s, and she was born in South Africa. And she was a woman with a big butt, and these two men found her in South Africa in Cape Town, and they first displayed her in – they sort of convinced her to do this show in South Africa where she was sort of displayed as a – essentially as a freak show, and then they brought her up to England, and then they displayed her as a freak show in London, And people paid money to basically come and see her, and they could pay even more money to touch her or poke her. And it's a really horribly sad story, and it really shows, I mean, there's many different parts of it. There was then a trial to determine whether she was in England of her own volition or if she had been enslaved, because at that time in England, there was a big question about, like, slavery had just become illegal, and that question was really potent. And the trial is one of the reasons we know so much about her. And then eventually she was brought to Paris by some other men and died there quite young. And then her body was dissected by a pretty famous French scientist named Georges Cuvier, who used the autopsy report and as evidence for the idea that African women were hypersexual and that African people were less human than Europeans. And then he displayed her body in his museum. And actually, her body parts were on display in Paris museums until the 1980s. It's a story that, like, there's the legacy, which we'll definitely talk about, but also, I mean, just the reality of her body and her that dissection, like the evidence and the kind of remains of of her autopsy were on display into my lifetime, which is just, I think it's important that we remember that, because it's also like a way to remember that none of this is really that far away at all.
And her remains weren't repatriated back to her home country until 2002.
Yeah, that's right. It took a really long time. After the fall of apartheid, there was a big push from South Africa, from people in South Africa, to get those remains back. But it took the French government quite a long time to finally repatriate them. But yeah, it took a really long time.
What was the fascination that these white Europeans had about her rear end? Why are people paying money to see this woman not from their area and paying extra money to be able to touch her butt?
I mean, I think it's such a good question. I think in that moment in England, there was a deep fascination with Africa, because there was, you know, colonization had really kicked into high gear, and the transatlantic slave trade was still happening, you know, pretty vehemently and you know, we always have to remember that the transatlantic slave trade, you know, it was called the Triangle Trade. It had three points, and the third point was England. So they're trying to, like, the kind of common UK person is trying to understand and kind of be involved with this colonial project. And she was kind of a specimen of empire. And that, you know, at the same time, one of the ways that the transatlantic slave trade was justified in Europe, in the US, was by suggesting that people from Africa weren't as human as everybody else.
As a matter of fact, that was Cuvier's result. What was it? He wrote that she was not.
That was
she was somewhere point. Closer to great apes than humans.
Exactly right. So, I mean, that's a way to make it
okay.
I mean, that was a way for them to make slavery okay, and to make it so that you know, to like justify what was essentially like one of the worst moral acts that has ever been committed in the history of the world. You know, it's like this was a way to for both the people of United Kingdom, the people of France, Cuvier himself, to kind of be okay with this thing that they had created.
But
you know, when Sarah Bartman comes up and they display her as a freak show, and they, you know, these men are saying, you know, she's not like you, it's a way of sort of making African women particularly separate from white women.
But it was also a sexualized concept too, right? I mean, it continues that thing where the people of color are highly sexualized. Cuvier was particularly interested in her sexual organs. And that sort of continues.
I think that's like such an important point. But like, one of the things that's happening in the 19th century is race is now, it's not just about skin color, but it also becomes about body type. So like,
right.
You kind of think about this, like famously, like the head shaped or the, you know, like nose shaped is another place that you can see this. But one of the things Cuvier is doing is creating these categories of race, which are invented categories by body shape. And he's saying that basically, like, women with big butts are more sexual than women with small butts. And that's part of this bigger project of making it so that it's, you know, African women are seen as more sexual than white women. And that is another mode of justifying the transatlantic slave trade and essentially the rape that is happening as part of that process.
Now, the 19th century was all, as you talk about in the book, apparently a lot of people were fascinated by butts or the rear ends or the, because it was also the era of the bustle. And
yeah,
I've never understood the, I never have understood the bustle. And you go to several people, and for people who aren't familiar with what the bustle is, talk about it.
Yeah, so the bustle is like, I mean, most people have probably seen it in like a period TV show or a play or something like that. It's like basically a big fake butt that women in the 19th century put on their, like strapped onto themselves, and then you wore a dress over it. So, you know, you just kind of looked like a woman with a big butt. Or there's another kind of way you can think about it is, you also kind of look like a piece of furniture because the way that the clothes were at the time, where they're really heavy, there's like very, a lot of frills and fringe and bows and stuff. So there's this kind of like way that a woman's body is almost turned into an object, as well as like, they also look like they have a big butt. And I was, you know, I was really interested in the question of like, what is this trend? Because, you know, there's a lot we kind of know and think about corsets. Like, I think most people have some idea of like, oh, they're restricting. It's about, you know, like women can't eat and breathe and whatever. But bustles are equally weird, and if not even maybe weirder. And I had never read much about it, so I went and did a bunch of research about it. And there's a bunch of different theories about why bustles were popular.
Well, didn't one person tell you, one fashion expert, well, just essentially shit happens in fashion. It's like, sometimes they just do weird things and it takes off.
That's a pretty common answer for fashion history. I mean, not really fashion historians, but kind of fashion people. It's like, there's this thing where it's like, who even knows? But, you know, as, I'm just kind of not a type of person who's like going to take that as an answer. Because, you know, things like that, I mean, it's true. Like, shit does happen in fashion. And, you know, we see that all the time. And there's always this kind of oscillation of bigness and smallness. And and so that's definitely a part of it. But there's also a thing that it's like, you know, it butts mean something. That's just sort of the whole point of the book on some level, is like butts represent other things. So like, what does it mean that at this point in history, kind of this weird big butt trend comes into fashion?
One of the things. Okay, go ahead. I love the research you do. For first of all, it answers a lot of questions I've always had. Like, how do women go to the bathroom when they have all this stuff down below there? I mean, some of these things have frames on them, and you said that a lot of the underwear was essentially open so they could just squat and pee.
Yeah, basically. I mean, that's the history of underwear.
That makes sense to me. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, and also like some of it's sort of unknown. Like, I asked this one fashion historian, like, if they're basically wearing crotchless underwear, then like, how are they dealing with their periods? And that's like actually something that's like, historians don't totally know the answer to those questions. So,
Wow.
I mean, these kind of intimate histories, they're actually like not exactly the kind of thing people like write down or write newspapers articles about or whatever. So sometimes they're really hard to know. But yeah, and the other thing that I think was so interesting about that research was, there's this idea that like, I don't know, like I kind of thought of the 19th century as so prim and proper, right?
Yeah.
But like, most people in the 19th century were pretty poor. There wasn't great sewage systems yet. And bodies were people were living close together in cities. And they really actually probably had a lot of interaction with each other's bodies and with bodily functions. And so even as like there's a lot of hiding of the body in Victorian clothes, there's also like, to some extent, it's not like the people who were actually living in that time, they weren't confused about what bodies were for or what bodies were doing. So while there may have been some prudery, there was also maybe some, it was a way of kind of like dealing with the fact that they were all kind of so close together in a new way for the first time, because cities were really changing at that time.
You did so much field work on this too. And I loved reading about that in the book too. When we were talking about bustles, you ended up going into the archives of the Victoria and Albert Museum, which sounded like quite an experience.
Yeah, it was so much fun. I wish I could have done even more, because I started this right before the pandemic hit, and I had to kind of... but I had so much fun going to the Victoria and Albert archives. They were so cool and beautiful. And I got to see these objects in person. And I used to work in museums. And one of the things I was really interested in is, like, what can objects tell us
yeah.
that...
Yeah.
words can't, because I think there's a way that, like I was saying, these kind of intimate histories, they're not the kind of things that are necessarily written down. And so there's a way that objects can help us to learn about the past in a way that's a little different, I think, than text-based sources. So, yeah, I went and I looked at these bustles, and it was really interesting to see them, to see the way that, like, the like some of them are kind of almost like mechanisms, like like these kind of like contraptions that kind of open and close, because it's also this kind of like, you have to think it's like almost like steampunk times, like it's like,
oh wow,
very like you know, science is churning and they're coming up with all these new ideas, and so like there are these kind of like almost like newfangled ways.
Wait a minute, they're not hiding things in their bustles, are they?
I mean, I don't know.
Are they hard or soft? Did you get to touch them? Were they soft or
well, they won't
springy?
Let you touch anything, but you can tell. Some of them are springs, like they're like metal, and some of them are like.
So they have skeletons in the bustle.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and the one I'm thinking of it's made of steel, and it kind of opens and closes like an accordion.
Wow.
Although that one, I always like, how does it open again? Like you'd have to sort of pull at it after you stood back up. Because the problem with the bustle was it was really hard to sit in, as you might.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the dresses themselves, some of them you could barely get through a door.
Well, yeah, well, that's one of the theories for why they invented the bustle, was because in the middle of the 19th century, dresses were so big, so like hoop-like, that the women literally couldn't walk through doors. And so one theory of the bustle is it's basically a hoop skirt that's kind of like pushed to the back so that you can walk through a door.
Wow. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is essayist, journalist, contributing editor, and reporter Heather Radke. And we're talking about a book. It's really fascinating, and there's a lot in it. Butts, a backstory. And I should mention, you have a discussion about terms for the rear end. And is butts the preferred term? Is that the one? Because I think when I was a kid, and I'm much older than you, I don't think we were sort of supposed to say butts.
What were you supposed to say?
My mother said derriere.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting because in most fashion magazines, they don't say butt until the 1990s, and they do say derriere.
Yeah, suddenly butts becomes okay.
Yeah, butts does become okay. And I think derriere is actually sort of almost so... there's something about like how hard you're trying not to say the word
right,
it feels sort of like gross, actually. But I was really interested in the question of what to call. I mean, I wanted to call it butts because
Did you grow up with butts?
Yeah, I would. I think I always said butts.
Your mother said butts?
I think my mother said butt. Yeah, I should ask her. Yeah, but I think that's what we called it. I mean, I think the thing about the word butt is it's like a little bit bad, like for a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not anywhere near it's not a hardcore swear word at all. So it's the kind of thing you can say and get a little laugh, but you're not going to get in a ton of trouble for saying it.
But you couldn't.
There's like nothing else to call it. There's not a one
well. Your backside. Your backside.
Backside is also it's like another kind of euphemism. Like there's a funny thing about butts where there's no. There's no like real word for it in the way that like breasts is the real word, you know?
Oh, you mean the accepted word. But you couldn't say butts on television, for instance, in the 1960s and I think the 1970s. But I'm not sure.
Oh, you couldn't. That's interesting.
I never heard the word butts on TV.
I would guess not. I would think. I wonder what they would say. I should go back.
So this is what your book does to you.
I know. That's the fun of it, as you start to think about it.
Oh my God!
Like, well, what do you call this part of your body in different kinds of company? Like, I talked to some doctors who are like colorectal surgeons and asked them what they call it with their patients. And some of them, most of them, call it butt or tuchus or
tuchus.
Use like a kind of like fun word because people are a little bit embarrassed in that moment of their life, so they try to take it down a notch. And I've actually heard that colorectal surgeons are some of the most fun surgeons because of that.
Jesus. One in a million, Doc. One in a million. Now, just to give the listeners how interesting your book is, because then you slip into the flapper era, which is like the diametrically opposed idea about your backside. Here we have flappers. And talk about Gordon Conway.
Yeah, so I was super interested in, like, if bustles are bigness, and I should just say the kind of other theory about the bustle is that it's actually modeled off of Sarah Bartman's body.
Yeah,
and that there was this kind of appropriation echo. And that's something that I explore throughout the book, is the way that white women kind of end up appropriating black women's bodies. So that's another theory of the bustle. And then in the flapper era, it's like all of a sudden, all of these big curves of Victorian time go away. And this woman, Gordon Conway, was an illustrator at that time. And her, along with a couple of other illustrators, really helped to bring in this this new idea of what a woman's body should look like. And like, it's something that we're probably so familiar with now, you don't even think about it. It's what they at the time called rectangle women. So it's like a woman without any curves at all, maybe just a little bit of breasts, a little bit of hips, but hardly anything else. And it was a pretty profound change, because during the Victorian era and then in the Gibson girl era, there's these kind of curves that signal femininity,
right.
But then all of a sudden curvelessness comes in. And in some ways that trend has stayed for the last 100 years.
But in the flapper era, and then later during, you know, the time of Kate Moss, the heroin chic era, which you explore in the book, it's a weird, it's like this unattainable goal for almost everybody, except for those women you see in the fashion magazines. In the case of the flappers, I always thought that they were associated with the angles that you find in Art Deco.
I mean, I think that's a super interesting way to think about it, because I think that it's all part of this kind of modernism that's happening, of a kind of sleekness, a kind of unadornment. And to some extent, that's also what's happening in fashion, that this idea of like the highly decorated 19th century is, there's like a real backlash to it that's coming after World War One, essentially.
Yeah. Now, again, I'm just picking and choosing and jumping around, but one of the other really freaky things I learned in your book is about Norma and Norman.
Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah. So
that's all this idea, and it's based in eugenics, of trying to find what's, quote, normal, and normal is conflated with perfection.
Yeah, I found this to be so interesting, and I had never heard of these statues before at all. And before I started, I found them for this research, because I had this idea. I was like, eugenicists surely have something to say about butts. And I called up a couple of eugenic scholars, and one of them pointed me towards these statues, which are like, you know, basically a couple of eugenicists made these two statues to show people what normal looked like and what they should be sort of essentially trying to achieve through like their eugenics procreation project, which is just so crazy. I mean, in some ways it's like they were like, it's like cattle at a state fair. It's like blue ribbon prize winning people. And they're not real people. They're statues that were made by collecting measurements in two really different ways for each of them. And then they made these statues and they were up at the American Museum of Natural History.
Yikes.
And then in Cleveland at this Cleveland Health Museum.
And when they were taking these measurements to try to find out the normal, quote, or a perfect body, they excluded people of color, didn't they?
Yeah, so the measurements for Norma, which is like obviously the woman figure, they were taken for a different purpose by a woman named Ruth O'Brien in the 30s as part of a project to try to figure out how to make women's clothes fit, how to create sizes that would, you know, make it so that you could actually buy clothes that fit, which, of course, nobody's ever figured out before.
So. Well, that's a whole other discussion in your book, is sizing and clothing. I never knew any of that. Thank you for providing that.
Yes. So Ruth O'Brien goes around, it's part of a WPA project. She hires all these people to go to a bunch of different cities in the U.S. and measure women, and so that she's going to basically create a bunch of different sizes based on the averages of what she finds in this study. But she just, basically anybody who's not considered white, they throw out the data for. So that's the data set that they get, both for the sizing of women's clothing, and then also it's used by these eugenicists who are making the Norma statue. It doesn't include any information about women of color.
And I can't believe these were on exhibition in the Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, well, the Museum of Natural History at that time was pretty bound up with eugenics, as frankly most American institutions were. I mean, all the major magazines wrote pro-eugenics stories. Most American universities had eugenics departments. It was a very pervasive thought that, you know, it really only went away in the post-war era. So it was really common and really well accepted. And I think that's important to remember too, because again, it can feel like these histories are long ago and so far away, but actually it's important to remember that probably most of us work for institutions that were part of that project.
One of the things I also found fascinating in your book, among many, was that you trace the butt back to prehistory and to Homo erectus. So, because as you write, things like chimps don't really have butts the way we do.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes people push back against that, but it's true. They don't have butts are uniquely human. They have something that's like at that part of their body, but they don't have this.
And it can change shape depending upon the sexual condition, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true too. But the things that we think of as the human butt, which are like two or three muscles, including the gluteus maximus, that's a uniquely human feature. And the butt developed as part of a larger set of adaptations that allowed us to be really good runners. And so I talked to the scientist Daniel Lieberman, who's done a lot of research on humans as endurance runners. And then I went to this race in...
Okay, that was totally freaking weird, and I never knew anything about that either, where humans are racing against horses?
Yeah, it's called the Man Against Horse Race. Pretty straightforward. And it's really fun if you're in Arizona, and if you're a distance runner or a distance rider, I highly recommend it, but also you can just go. And these people, it's a 50-mile race, which is wild, and humans run against horses. And I went there actually with my Radiolab co-reporting partner, Matt Kilty, and we recorded it and made a little episode of Radiolab about it. And
how long has it been going on?
I think it's been going on since the early 80s in some iteation or another. And it started as a barroom bet between like one guy.
Boy, does it sound like a barroom bet. You talk about something that is clearly a barroom bet. But, you know, people would think like, well, the horses are going to win.
I know, you would think the horse is going to win. And frankly, the horses do win a lot of the time. But I think the point of the race, and sort of the reason I went there, is that it's possible for humans to outrun horses. And it's actually probably even more possible in a different environment than the one that the race happens in, which is like on the savannas of Africa. Because humans are able to run for long distances. And animals like horses and antelope and cheetahs, four-legged animals, they actually they can run really, really fast, but they can't
for short distance. And people are going to have to learn about how the butt figures into that by buying the book. My guest tonight is essayist, journalist, contributing editor and reporter Heather Radke. And we've been talking about her book, and as you can tell, it just generates 1,000 conversations. Butts, a Backstory. Heather, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.